west, so that was the way she went. The heat beat on her as she continued her walk, forcing her to take a few more conservative water breaks. She kept reminding herself it wasn't a race and that she should take it easy. After a few more clues, she discovered the map wasn't quite to scale, so it wasn't always obvious how long each leg of the hike was. Nonetheless, she was delighted to successfully solve each clue, though the rewards became more and more baffling. One of them was a bunch of sticks sitting on a rock, something she would have sworn was a mistake. But someone civilized had clearly tied the bundle together. She added that into her bag, along with a neatly folded green plastic tarp. By now, sweat was pouring off her, and rolling up the sleeves of her button-down cotton shirt did little to help. She took more frequent breaks. Sunburn became a serious concern. So it was a huge relief when her next clue led to a bottle of sunscreen. After a couple hours of battling the intense summer heat, Lissa became so hot and tired that she no longer had the mental energy to be annoyed about missing out on whatever was happening at court. All that mattered was getting to the end of this test. The map showed two more clues, which she took as a promising sign. She would reach the end soon and then could simply wait for someone to get her. A flash of realization hit her. The tarp. The tarp was a sunblock, she decided. She could use it at the end. This cheered her up, as did the next prize, more water and a floppy wide-brimmed hat that helped keep the sunlight from her face. Unfortunately, after that, what appeared to be a short leg of the trip turned out to be twice as long as she expected. By the time she finally reached the next clue, she was more interested in taking a water break than digging out whatever else the guardians had left her. My heart went out to her. I wished so, so badly that I could help. That was my job, to protect her. She shouldn't be alone. Or should she? Was that also part of the test? In a world where royals were almost always surrounded by guardians, this solitude had to be a total shock. Moroi were hardy and had excellent senses, but they weren't built for extreme heat and challenging terrain. I could have probably jogged the course easily. Admittedly, I wasn't sure I would have had Lissa's deductive skills in figuring out the clues. Lissa's last reward was flint and steel. Not that she had any idea what they were. I recognized them instantly as the tools of a fire-making kit, but couldn't for the world figure out why she'd need to build a fire on a day like this. With a shrug, she added the items to her bag and kept going. And that's when things started to get cold. Really cold. She didn't entirely process it at first, mainly because the sun was still shining so brilliantly. Her brain said what she felt was impossible, but her goosebumps and chattering teeth said otherwise. She rolled her sleeves back down and quickened her pace, wishing that the sudden cold had at least come with cloud cover. Walking faster and exerting herself more helped heat her body. Until it began to rain. It started off as a mist, then changed to drizzle, and finally turned into a steady curtain of water. Her hair and clothing became soaked, making the cold temperature that much worse. Yet, the sun still shone. Its light an annoyance to her sensitive skin, but offering no warmth in compensation. Magic, she realized. This weather is magical. It was part of the test. Somehow, Moroi air and water magic users had united to defy the hot, sunny weather. That was why she had a tarp, to block the sun and the rain. She considered getting it out now and wearing it like a cloak, but quickly decided to wait until she reached the end point. She had no idea how far away that really was, though. 20 feet? 20 miles? The chill of the rain crept over her, seeping under her skin. It was miserable. The cell phone in the bag was her ticket out. It was barely late afternoon. She had a long time to wait before this test ended. All she had to do was make one call. One call, and she'd be out of this mess and back to working on what she should be at court. No. A kernel of determination flared up within her. This challenge was no longer about the Moroi throne or Tatiana's murder. It was a test she would take on for herself. She'd led a soft and sheltered life, letting others protect her. She would endure this on her own. And she would pass. This determination took her to the map's end, a clearing ringed in trees. Two of the trees were small and close enough together that Lissa thought she might be able to drape the tarp into some sort of a reasonable shelter. With cold, fumbling fingers, she managed to get it out of the bag and unfold it to its full size, which was fortunately much larger than she'd suspected. Her mood began to lift as she worked with the tarp and figured out how to create a small canopy. She crawled inside once it was complete, glad to be out of the falling rain. But that didn't change the fact that she was wet, or that the ground was also wet and muddy. The tarp also didn't protect her against the cold. She felt a flash of bitterness, recalling the guardian saying magic was allowed in this test. She hadn't thought magic would be useful at the time, but now she could certainly see the perks of being a water user to control the rain and keep it off her. Or better yet, being a fire user. She wished Christian was with her. She would have welcomed the warmth of both his magic and his embrace. For this kind of situation, spirits seriously sucked. Unless perhaps she got hypothermia and needed to try to heal herself, which never worked as well as it did on other people. No, she decided. There could be no question. Water and fire users had the advantage in this test. That's when it hit her. Fire. Lissa straightened up from where she'd been huddled. She hadn't recognized the iron and flint for what they were, but now, vague recollections of fire-making were coming back to her. She'd never been taught those skills directly, but was pretty sure striking the stones together would make a spark. If she only had dry wood. Everything out there was soaked. Except for the bundle of sticks in her bag. Laughing out loud, she untied the sticks and set them in a place shielded from the rain. After arranging them in what seemed like a campfire-friendly pattern, she tried to figure out what to do with the steel and flint. In movies, she thought she'd seen people just hit them to make sparks fly. So, that's what she did. Nothing happened. She tried three more times, and her earlier excitement gave way to spirit-darkened frustration. I pulled some of that from her, needing her to stay focused. On the fourth try, a spark flew off and faded away. But it was what she needed to understand the principle. Before long, she could easily make sparks, but they did nothing when they landed on the wood. Up and down. Her mood was a roller coaster of hope and disappointment. Don't give up, I wanted to say as I drew off more negativity. Don't give up. I also wanted to give her a lesson on kindling, but that was pushing my limits. Watching her, I was beginning to realize how much I underestimated Lissa's intelligence. I knew she was brilliant, but I always imagined her being helpless in these situations. She wasn't. She could reason things out. That tiny spark couldn't penetrate the wood of the sticks. She needed a bigger flame. She needed something the sparks could ignite. But what? Surely nothing in this waterlogged forest. Her eyes fell on the map poking out of her bag. She hesitated only a moment before ripping and shredding the paper into a pile on top of the twigs. Supposedly, she'd reached the end of the hike and didn't need the map. Supposedly. But it was too late now, and Lissa pushed forward with her plan. First, she pulled out some of the bag's fluffy lining, adding the bits of fuzz to the paper. Then she took up the flint and steel again. A spark jumped out and immediately caught a piece of the paper. It flared orange before fading out, leaving a wisp of smoke. She tried again, leaning forward to gently blow on the paper when the spark landed. A tiny flame appeared, caught a neighboring shred, and then faded. Steeling herself up, Lissa tried a final time. "Come on, come on," she muttered, as though she might compel a fire into existence. This time, the spark caught and held, turning into a small flame, then a larger flame that soon consumed her kindling. I prayed it would take to the wood, or else she was out of luck. Brighter and larger the flame grew, eating the last of the paper and fuzz, and then spreading along the sticks. Lissa blew softly to keep it going, and before long the campfire was in full blaze. The fire couldn't change the piercing cold, but as far as she was concerned, she had the warmth of the entire sun in her hands. She smiled, and a sense of pride that she hadn't felt in a while spread within her. Finally able to relax, she glanced out at the rainy forest and caught the faintest flashes of color in the distance. Channeling spirit, she used her magic to intensify her ability to see auras. Sure enough, hidden far, far out among the trees, she could see two auras filled with strong, steady colors. Their owners stood still, staying quiet and covered. Lissa's smile grew. Guardians. Or maybe the air and water users controlling the weather. None of the candidates were alone out here. Ronald O'Zara had had no need to worry. But then, he wouldn't know that. Only she did. Maybe spirit wasn't so useless out here after all. The rain began to lighten, and the fire's warmth continued to soothe her. She couldn't read the time from the sky, but somehow she knew she would have no problem waiting out the day, and... Rose? A voice summoned me out of Lissa's wilderness survival. Rose, wake up, or whatever. I blinked, focusing on Sydney's face, which was a few inches from mine. What? I demanded. Why are you bothering me? She flinched and jerked away, momentarily speechless. Pulling away Lissa's darkness while joined with her hadn't affected me at the time, but now, conscious in my own body, I felt anger and irritation flood me. It's not you, it's not Sydney, I told myself. It's spirit. Calm down. I took a deep breath, refusing to let spirit master me. I was stronger than it was. I hoped. As I fought to push those feelings down, I looked around and remembered I was in Sonia Karp's bedroom. All my problems came rushing back. There was a bound Strigoi in the other room, one we were barely keeping constrained and who didn't seem like she would give us answers anytime soon. I looked back at Sydney, who still seemed afraid of me. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to snap at you. I was just startled. She hesitated a few moments and then nodded, accepting my apology. As the fear faded from her face, I could see that something else was bothering her. What's wrong? I asked. As long as we were alive and Sonia was still trapped, things couldn't be that bad, right? Sydney stepped back and crossed her arms. Victor Dashkov and his brother are here. Chapter 18. I sprang up from my bed, relieved that I didn't fall over. My head still hurt, but I no longer felt dizzy, which hopefully meant I really had evaded a concussion. Glancing at an alarm clock as I left Sonia's bedroom, I saw that I'd been in Lissa's head for a few hours. Her test had been far more extensive than I'd realized. In the living room, I found an almost comical sight. Victor and Robert stood there, in the flesh, taking in the surrounding details. Even Robert seemed to be with us mentally this time, only whereas Victor was studying everything in his calculating way, Robert's attention was fixed on Sonia. His eyes bugged out in astonishment. Dmitri, meanwhile, hadn't altered his position near Sonya or put away the stake at her throat. It was clear from his stance and watchful gaze, however, that he regarded the brothers as a new threat and was trying, impossibly, to stay on guard against everything. He seemed relieved to see me and have some backup. Sonya had gone perfectly still within her chains, which I didn't like at all. It made me think she was planning something. Her red eyes narrowed. The whole situation was tense and dangerous, but a tiny part of me felt smug satisfaction as I studied Victor more closely. The dream meetings had been deceptive. Just as I could shift my appearance in dreams, Victor had made himself look stronger and healthier in those visits than he actually was in real life. Age, disease, and life on the run were taking their toll. Dark shadows lined his eyes, and his graying hair seemed thinner than it had a month ago. He looked haggard and tired, but I knew he was still dangerous. "So," I said, hands on hips, "you managed to find us."
"There's one lake in this town," said Victor. "One blue house. Maybe you had trouble with those directions. But for the rest of us,
it wasn't that difficult."
"Well, if you're so smart, what's your plan now?" I asked.
I was trying to stall as I frantically thought about what my plan was. I'd wanted to capture Victor and Robert, but didn't know how. Since we had to split our attention between them and Sonya, Dmitri and I couldn't team up. I wished we had leftover chain. Aside from physically subduing the brothers, we would also specifically need to restrain their hands to reduce their ability to use magic.
"Since you're so smart," countered Victor, "I assumed you'd have already obtained the needed information."
I gestured toward Sonya.
"She's not exactly forthcoming."
Victor's eyes fell on her.
"Sonya Karp, you've changed since I last saw you."
"I'm going to kill you all," Sonya snarled, "and consume you one by one. Normally, I'd start with the human and work up to the Moroi, but..."
She glanced at Dmitri and me, her face full of rage.
"I think I'll save you two for last and drag out your suffering."
She paused and almost comically added,
"You've annoyed me the most."
"Do all Strigoi go through some boot camp and learn all the same threats? It's a wonder you don't cackle too." I turned back to Victor.
"See? Not that easy. We've tried everything. Beaning it out, torturing it out. Sydney went through the names of all her relatives. No reaction."
Victor studied Sydney in detail for the first time.
"So, your pet alchemist?"
Sydney didn't move. I knew she had to be scared of facing someone who was both a vampire and a dangerous criminal. I had to give her points for meeting his stare unflinchingly.
"Young," Victor mused. "But of course she would be. I imagine it's the only way you could manipulate her into this little escapade."
"I'm here by choice," replied Sydney. Her expression stayed calm and confident. "No one manipulated me." Abe's blackmail wasn't really relevant at the moment.
"Look, if you wanted to keep torturing me with your not-funny comments, you could have just kept invading my dreams," I snapped. "If you don't have anything useful to offer, then get out of here and let us wait until hunger weakens Sonya."
And by get out of here, I meant, foolishly think you're going to leave so that I can knock your heads together and drag you back to the Guardians.
"We can help," said Victor. He touched his brother lightly on the arm. Robert flinched, jerking his eyes from Sonya to Victor.
"Your methods were destined to fail. If you want answers, there's only one way to..."
Sonya made her move. Dmitri was still right next to her, but he'd also been keeping an eye on the rest of us. And of course, I'd been completely focused on the Victor drama as well. It was probably the best opening Sonya could have hoped for.
With crazy Strigoi strength, she bucked up from the chair. The chain was wrapped around her over and over, but a quick movement and strength were enough to snap the chain in two places. The rest still encircled her, but I knew perfectly well even one opening was enough for her to eventually bust out. Distracted or not, Dimitri was on her in a flash, and a second later, so was I. She was flailing in the chair, using every bit of her strength and speed to shake off the chains. If she got loose, I knew she'd put up another fierce fight. Dimitri and I met eyes briefly, and I knew we were thinking the same things. First, how were we going to re-restrain her? The chain could probably be rebound, but we'd need to unwind it and start over, which would be next to impossible. We also both knew he and I might not be able to take her down a second time, and now we had innocents around. They couldn't fight, but Sonya might be able to use them to her advantage somehow. All we could do was try to keep her down. Holding her against a flat surface like the floor would have been much easier than the unwieldy recliner. It shook as she fought against us, and we struggled to get a good position on the chair. Dimitri had his stake. I'd set mine down earlier, and he raked it against her skin, giving us some advantage in the struggle. She screamed in rage, and I clung to the hope we might tire her out. Probably not. We'd break first. My aching head was proof enough that I wasn't in peak condition. I saw a flash of movement in my periphery, setting off new alarms. Robert Giroux was heading toward us, and he had a silver stake in his hand. The sight was so bizarre and unexpected that I was slow to alert Dimitri. When my sluggish mind suddenly kicked back to life, it was too late. "No!" I shrieked, seeing Robert raise the stake. "Don't kill her!" Dimitri turned and saw Robert then, but there was nothing he could do. Dimitri and I had created the perfect opportunity. We were holding Sonya still, and with her chest vulnerable, Robert had a clean shot. Frantically, I wondered what to do. If I stopped him, I'd release Sonya. If I didn't stop him, he might kill our only chance of finding out who... Too late. The stake plunged down with a force that astonished me. Lissa had had a very difficult time staking Dimitri, and I'd assumed the same would be true for someone like Robert, who was older and seemed so fragile. But no, he still had to use two hands, but the stake went firmly into Sonia's chest, piercing her heart. Sonya let out an intense scream. A brilliant, blinding white light suddenly filled the room, just as an unseen force blasted me away. I hit a wall, my brain barely registering the pain. The small house shook, and with one hand, I tried to grab something and brace myself. I squeezed my eyes shut, but could still see starbursts. Time slowed. My heartbeat slowed. Then, it all stopped. Everything. The light, the tremors. I breathed normally. All was quiet and still, as though I'd imagined what had just happened. I blinked, trying to bring my eyes back into focus and assess the situation. I did my best to scramble clumsily to my feet and saw Dimitri was doing the same. He looked like he'd also been knocked over but had caught the wall for support, rather than smashing into it. Robert was lying flat out on the floor, and Victor rushed over to help him. Sydney just stood frozen. And Sonya? Unbelievable, I whispered. Sonya was still in the armchair, and from the way she was sitting back, it was obvious that she'd been blasted by the same force that had hit the rest of us. The chains were still around her, but she'd stopped struggling. On her lap was the silver stake Robert had held only moments ago. Sonya managed to wiggle a hand out of the chain, just enough for her fingers to brush against the stake's surface. Her eyes widened with wonder. Eyes that were a rich azure blue. Robert had brought Sonya Karp back to life. She was no longer Strigoi. When Lissa had saved Dimitri, I'd felt the magic's power through the bond, giving me the full and overwhelming experience of it all. Witnessing it now, without the first-hand knowledge provided from Lissa, was still just as incredible. Victor was preoccupied with Robert, but the rest of us couldn't stop staring at Sonya in amazement. I kept looking for anything, anything that might give the slightest hint of her previous existence. There was none. Her skin bore the typical Maroi paleness, but it was still filled with the warmth of life, with the faintest tinge of color, not like the Strigoi, who were completely devoid of pigment. Her eyes were bloodshot, but that was from her rapidly forming tears. There was no red ring around her irises, and the look in those eyes? There was no cruelty or malice. They were not the eyes of someone who had just threatened to kill us all. Her eyes were all shock and fear and confusion. I couldn't tear my gaze from her. A miracle. Another miracle. Even after seeing Lyssa restore Dimitri, some secret part of me had believed I would never witness anything like it again. That was how miracles worked. Once in a lifetime. There'd been a lot of talk about using spirit to save Strigoi everywhere. Talk that had faded when other drama, such as the murder of a queen, took precedence at court. The shortage of spirit users had also made the idea unpopular, and besides, everyone knew the difficulties involved with a Maroi staking a Strigoi. If trained guardians died fighting Strigoi, how could a Maroi stake one? Well, here was the answer. A subdued Strigoi. A Maroi could manage staking one with two hands, especially with guardian backup. The possibilities made me reel. Robert's magic was strong, but he was old and frail. Yet if he had still done this, could any spirit user? He'd almost made it look easy. Could Adrian do it? Could Lyssa do it again? A miracle. Sonia Karp was a living, breathing miracle. And suddenly, she began screaming. It started off as kind of a low wail and rapidly grew in volume. The noise snapped me to attention, but I didn't exactly know how to respond. Dimitri did. His stake fell from his hand, and he rushed to Sonia's side, where he began trying to free her from the chains. She floundered at his touch, but her efforts no longer packed the supernatural strength of an undead monster seeking revenge. These were the motions of someone desperately, terribly afraid. I'd wrapped those chains pretty securely, but Dimitri had them off in seconds. Once Sonia was free, he sat in the chair and pulled her to him, letting her bury her face against his chest and sob. I swallowed. Dimitri had also wept when he had been changed back. An odd image of newborn babies flashed through my mind. Was crying the natural reaction for anyone being born? Or, in this case, reborn into the world? A sudden movement grabbed my attention. Sydney's eyes were wide and she was actually moving toward Dimitri to stop him.
"What are you doing?" she cried. "Don't release her!"
Dimitri ignored Sydney, and I caught hold of her, pulling her back. "It's okay, it's okay," I said. Sydney was the most stable factor in this whole operation. I couldn't have her freaking out. "She's not Strigoi. Look, look at her. She's Maroi." Sydney slowly shook her head.
"She can't be. I just saw her."
"It's what happened to Dimitri. Exactly the same. You don't think he's a Strigoi, do you? You trust him." I released my hold on her, and she stayed put, her face wary. Looking down at the brothers, I realized theirs might be a more serious situation than I had realized. Robert, while not a Strigoi, looked pale enough to be one. His eyes were vacant, drool escaping his partially open mouth. I reassessed my earlier observation about Robert making Strigoi restoration look easy. He'd staked her like a pro, but obviously, there were a few side effects. Victor was trying to support his brother and murmured soothing and encouraging words. And on Victor's face, well, there was a look of compassion and fear that I'd never seen before. My brain didn't entirely know how to reconcile it with my well-defined and villainous image of him. He seemed like a real person. Victor glanced up at me, his lips twisting into a bitter smile.
What? No witty quips now? You should be happy. We've given you what you wanted. You need answers from Sonia Karp?
He nodded toward her.
Go get them. They've certainly come at a high price.
No!
Exclaimed Dmitri. He still held Sonia against him, but his gentle expression turned hard at Victor's words.
Are you crazy? Didn't you see what just happened?
Victor arched an eyebrow.
Yes, I noticed.
She's in no condition to answer anything. She's in shock. Leave her alone.
Don't act like she's the one who's suffering here, snapped Victor.
Turning back to Robert, Victor helped his brother stand and go toward the couch. Robert barely managed it, his legs trembling and then giving way as he sat down. Victor put an arm around Robert.
You'll be all right. Everything's all right.
Will he be? I asked uncertainly. Robert didn't look like he was in all that good of shape. My earlier thoughts about spirit users saving Strigoi continued growing unrealistic.
He did it before and recovered, right? And Lyssa's fine.
Robert was much younger, as is Vasilisa, replied Victor, patting Robert's shoulder. And this is hardly a simple spell. Doing it even once is monumental.
Twice?
Well, you and I both know how spirit works. And this feat takes a toll on both body and mind. Robert has made a great sacrifice for you.
He had, I supposed. Thank you, Robert, I said. The words came hesitantly to my lips. Robert didn't seem to hear. Dmitri stood up, lifting Sonia easily in his arms. She was still crying, but her sobs were quieter now.
She needs to rest, he said gruffly. Believe me, you have no idea what's going on inside her right now.
Oh, I believe you, I said.
You're idiots, snapped Victor. Both of you.
It was a wonder Dmitri's glare didn't pin Victor to the floor.
No interrogation yet.
I nodded my agreement, not knowing what else to do. When Lyssa had changed Dmitri, she'd taken on a fierce, similarly protective attitude. He might not have been the one to change Sonia, but he was the only one here who had any idea what she was going through. I knew he'd had a hard adjustment and that the initial effects of the restoration had been disorienting. That wasn't even taking into account the subsequent depression. He swept past all of us, taking Sonia to her bedroom. Sydney watched them go and then glanced over to the sofa, where Victor still had his arm wrapped around his brother. The alchemist met my eyes wonderingly.
I heard, but I didn't believe.
Sometimes, I told her, I still don't. It goes against every rule of the universe. To my surprise, she touched the small gold cross around her neck.
Some rules are bigger than the universe.
Victor rose from the couch, apparently satisfied Robert was resting. I tensed up. Miracles aside, he was still a criminal, one I intended to capture. He took a step toward me, pitching his voice low.
Sorry to interrupt Metaphysics 101, but you need to listen to me, he said. Be careful, Rose. Very careful. A lot rests on you now. Don't let your pet wolf keep you from finding out what Sonia knows.
But he's right, I exclaimed. It's been 5 minutes. What she went through, what they both went through, well, it's kind of a big deal. Literally life-changing. He had to recover too and adjust to being saved. Once she does, she'll help us.
Are you sure? He asked, narrowing his eyes. Will she think she's been saved? You forget. Belikov was turned against his will.
She wasn't. What are you saying? That she's going to try to become Strigoi again? He shrugged.
I'm saying get your answer soon.
and don't leave her alone. With that, Victor turned and headed toward the kitchen. He soon returned with a glass of water. Robert drank it greedily and then fell into a heavy sleep. I sighed and leaned against a wall near Sydney, totally worn out. I still hurt from the earlier fight. "What now?" asked Sydney. I shook my head. "I don't know. We wait, I guess." Dimitri returned a little while later and spared a small glance for Robert.
"She's sleeping too," he told me. "The transformation. It's difficult."
I could see a haunted look in his eyes and wondered what memory was tormenting him now. The memory of being changed? The memory of being Strigoi? "I don't think we should leave Sonia alone," I said. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Victor smirk. "Someone should stay with her in case she wakes up. She won't know what's going on." Dimitri didn't answer for a few seconds as he scrutinized me. He knew me well enough to sense there might be something else on my mind. Fortunately, he couldn't find a fault in my logic.
"You're right. Do you mind sitting with her?" he asked Sydney.
I groped for something to say. No. No, not Sydney. If Sonia did turn on us, we needed someone else on guard. Someone who could fight back. Sydney, probably guessing my problem, saved me from lying to Dimitri, or from telling him the truth about my concerns.
"She doesn't know me. It might make things worse when she wakes up. Besides..."
Sydney put on that disgusted expression that alchemists excelled at.
"I don't really feel that comfortable with someone who was a monster 5 minutes ago."
"She's not Strigoi," he exclaimed. "She's absolutely completely Maroi again."
Even I felt a little cowed by the harshness of his voice, but I wasn't entirely surprised at his vehement reaction. He'd had a hard time convincing others he'd changed. His face softened a little.
"I know it's hard to believe, but she really has changed."
"I'll stay with her then," I said.
"No, no."
Dimitri shook his head.
"Sydney's right about one thing. Sonia might be confused. It's better if someone's there who understands what's happened."
I started to argue that I was the only one Sonia really knew, but then decided I'd rather stay with the brothers. They seemed harmless now, but I didn't trust them. Dimitri apparently didn't either. He took a few steps forward and leaned down, speaking only an inch from my ear.
"Keep an eye on them," he murmured. "Robert's down right now, but might recover sooner than we think."
"I know." He started to turn, then glanced back at me. His commander face had softened into something thoughtful and awestruck.
"Rose?"
"Yeah?"
Was that what he was like when Lisa changed me?"
"More or less."
"I didn't realize it was..."
He struggled for words. It was uncharacteristic.
"The way that light filled the room. The way she changed. Seeing that life emerge from death. It was..."
"Beautiful?" He nodded.
"Life like that. You don't... No, you can't waste it."
"No," I agreed. "You can't." I saw something shift in him then. It was small, just like in the alley. But I knew then another piece of the Strigoi trauma had peeled away. He said no more, and I watched as he walked back down the hall. With nothing else to do, Sydney sat down cross-legged on the floor, holding a book in her lap. It was closed, her thoughts clearly elsewhere. Meanwhile, Victor sat back in the armchair and reclined it. He didn't look as bad as Robert, but lines of fatigue showed on both brothers. Good. The longer they were out of commission, the better. I brought in a chair from the kitchen so I could sit and survey the room. Everything was peaceful. I felt like a babysitter, which I suppose I kind of was. It had been a long day, and night soon turned the windows black. This worried me. For all I knew, Sonia had some Strigoi pals who might stop by. The fact that Donovan knew her certainly indicated she wasn't a total outcast among them. It made me extra vigilant, but at the same time, I was exhausted. The brothers were already asleep. Sydney, perhaps in an attempt to keep her human schedule, eventually found a spare blanket and pillow and curled up in a makeshift bed on the floor. And me? I was halfway between human and vampiric schedules. I had a feeling Dimitri was the same. Really, we were on a do-what's-necessary schedule, in which extensive sleep was not an option. A hum of excitement and astonishment suddenly sang through the bond. I sensed no danger or threat, but curiosity made me decide to check in with Lissa anyway. Even if I was in her mind, I knew my body would stay watchful, and I wanted to know how the rest of Lissa's test had gone. Beautifully, of course. She rode back to court exhausted but proud of herself. She wasn't the only one. The rest of her companions all wore similar expressions. All except for Ava Drozdov. She had been the only one to break and use the cell phone to call for help. Lissa was surprised that Ava had cracked. After his earlier bitching, Marcus Lazar had seemed the most likely to bail. But no, the old man had managed it somehow, meaning he'd continue on in the Monarch trials. Ava refused to make eye contact with anyone, instead staring bleakly out the window as they traveled back to court. She would still hold a counsel spot, but her shot at being queen was gone. Lissa felt bad for her, but couldn't spare too much concern. It was the way of the trials, the way they determined the best candidates. Besides, Lissa had her own issues. Staying out in the daytime had run contrary to the normal vampiric schedule. Now she simply wanted to get back to court, find her room, and sleep for a few hours. She wanted some peace. Instead, she found a mob waiting for her.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Vampire Academy Book 6, Last Sacrifice, by Rochelle Mead. Read by Emily Schaefer. Chapter 19. The van's parked in a semi-remote part of court, so seeing the area packed with eager Maroi was quite a shock to Lissa. Guardians moved through the people like ghosts, just as they had at the nomination session, keeping as much order as possible. The crowd kept getting in the way as the vans attempted to reach the garages, and faces looked in the windows, trying to get a glimpse of the royal candidates. Lissa stared at the masses in shock, almost afraid to get out. Ariana gave her a comforting smile.
This is normal. They all want to know who made it and who didn't.
They especially want to know. She inclined her head toward the front of the van. Peering through the windshield, Lissa spied the other six candidates. Because the forest course could only accommodate so many people, the group had been split in half. The rest of the candidates would take the same test tomorrow and were no doubt curious who among their competitors had passed today. Lissa was used to order and decorum around royals, so she was astonished to see such eagerness and frenzy among them now. And of course, the common Maroi, who'd been arriving at court, were mixed into the crowd too. Everyone was pushing, peering over the heads of others to find out what had happened. People were shouting some of the candidates' names, and I was half surprised they hadn't come up with songs and banners. Lissa and her companions exited the van and were met with a wave of cheers that rippled through the crowd. it became obvious pretty quickly who had passed and who hadn't. This sent the crowd abuzz even more. Lissa stood rooted to the spot, staring around and feeling lost. It was one thing to rationally discuss the pros of her running for queen with her friends. It was an entirely different matter to suddenly be thrust into what the elections truly meant. Her focus had been limited to a few things. My safety, finding the murderer, and surviving the tests. Now, as she took in the crowd, she realized the election was bigger than her. Bigger than anything she could have imagined. For these people, it wasn't a joke. It wasn't a scam to twist the law and stall for time. Their lives were figuratively on the line. Maroy and Dompiers lived inside various countries and obeyed those laws. But they also obeyed this government, the one that operated out of the court. It reached around the world and affected every Dompier and Maroy who chose to stay in our society. We had some voting, yes, but the king or queen shaped our futures. The guardians in charge of the crowds finally gave the okay for family members to push through the masses and collect their nominees. Lissa had no one. Both Janine and Eddie, despite their earlier claims, were occasionally given temporary tasks that prevented them from being with Lissa 24/7, and she certainly had no family to come for her. Adrift, she felt dizzy in the chaos, still stunned by her moment of clarity. Conflicting emotions warred within her. Deceiving everyone made her feel unworthy, like she should resign her candidacy right now. At the same time, she suddenly wanted to be worthy of the elections. She wanted to hold her head high and walk into the tests proudly, even if she was taking them for ulterior motives. A strong hand at last caught hold of her arm. Christian.
Come on, let's get out of here.
He pulled her away, shouldering through the onlookers.
Hey,
he called to a couple guardians on the crowd's periphery.
A little help here for the princess?
It was the first time I had ever seen him act like a royal, throwing around the authority of his bloodline. To me, he was snarky, cynical Christian. In Maroy society, at 18, he could now technically be addressed as Lord Ozera. I'd forgotten that. The two guardians hadn't. They rushed to Lissa's side, helping Christian part the crowd. The faces around her were a blur, the noise a dull roar. Yet every once in a while, something would come through to her. The chanting of her name, declarations about the return of the dragon, which was the symbol of the Dragomir family. This is real, she kept thinking. This is real. The guardians officially led her out of it all and back across the court's grounds to her building. They released her once they considered her safe, and she graciously thanked them for their help. When she and Christian were in a room, she sank onto the bed, stunned.
Oh my God, she said. That was insane.
Christian smiled.
Which part? Your welcome home party or the test itself? You look like you just... Well, I'm not really sure what you just did.
Lissa took a quick survey of herself. They'd given her dry towels on the ride home, but her clothing was still damp and was wrinkled as it dried. Her shoes and jeans had mud all over them, and she didn't even want to think about what her hair looked like.
Yeah, we...
The words stuck on her tongue, and not because she suddenly decided not to tell him.
I can't say, she murmured. It really worked. The spell won't let me.
What spell?
He asked. Lissa rolled up her sleeve and lifted the bandage to show him the tiny tattooed dot on her arm.
It's a compulsion spell, so I won't talk about the test, like the alchemists have.
Wow,
he said, truly impressed.
I never actually thought those worked.
I guess so. It's really weird. I want to talk about it, but I just can't.
It's okay,
he said, brushing some of her damp hair aside.
You passed. That's what matters. Just focus on that.
The only thing I want to focus on right now is a shower. Which is kind of ironic, considering how soaked I am.
She didn't move, though, and instead stared off at the far wall.
Hey,
said Christian gently.
What's wrong? Did the crowd scare you?
She turned back to him.
No, that's the thing. I mean, they were intimidating, yeah. But I just realized. I don't know. I realized I'm part of a major process. One that's gone on since...
The beginning of time?
Teased Christian, quoting Nathan's nonsensical statement.
Nearly,
she answered with a small smile that soon faded.
This goes beyond tradition, Christian. The elections are a core part of our society. Ingrained. We can talk about changing age laws or fighting or whatever, but this is ancient and far-reaching. Those people out there, they're not all Americans. They've come from other countries. I forget sometimes that even though the court is here, it rules Maroi everywhere. What happens here affects the whole world.
Where are you going with this?
He asked. She was lost in her own thoughts and couldn't see Christian as objectively as I could. He knew Lyssa. He understood her and loved her. The two of them had a synchronicity similar to what Dimitri and I shared. Sometimes, however, Lyssa's thoughts spun in directions he couldn't guess. He'd never admit it, but I knew part of why he loved her was that, unlike me, who everyone knew was impetuous, Lyssa always seemed the picture of calmness and rationality. Then, she'd do something totally unexpected. Those moments delighted him, but sometimes scared him because he never knew just how much her old spirit was playing in her actions. Now was one of those times. He knew the elections were stressing her, and like me, he knew that could bring out the worst.
I'm going to take these tests seriously, she said. It's shameful not to. An insult to our society. My ultimate goal is to find out who framed Rose. But in the meantime, I'm going to go through the trials like someone who intends to be queen.
Christian hesitated before speaking, a rarity for him.
Do you want to be queen?
That snapped Lyssa from her dreamy philosophizing about tradition and honor.
No, of course not. I'm 18. I can't even drink yet.
That's never stopped you from doing it,
he pointed out, becoming more like his usual self.
I'm serious. I want to go to college. I want Rose back. I don't want to rule the Maroi nation.
A sly look lit Christian's blue eyes.
You know, Aunt Tasha makes jokes about how you'd actually be a better queen than the others. Except sometimes, I don't think she's joking.
Lyssa groaned and stretched back on the bed.
I love her, but we've got to keep her in check. If anyone could actually get that law changed, it would be her and her activist friends.
Well, don't worry. The thing about her activist friends is that they have so much to protest, they don't usually get behind one thing at the same time.
Christian stretched out beside her and pulled her close.
But for what it's worth, I think you'd be a great queen too, Princess Dragomir.
You're going to get dirty, she warned.
Already am. Oh, you mean from your clothes?
He wrapped his arms around her, heedless of her damp and muddy state.
I spent most of my childhood hiding in a dusty attic and own exactly one dress shirt. You really think I care about this t-shirt?
She laughed and then kissed him, letting her mind free itself of worry for a moment and just savor the feel of his lips. Considering they were on a bed, I wondered if it was time for me to go. After several seconds, she pulled back and sighed contentedly.
You know, sometimes I think I love you.
Sometimes?
He asked in mock outrage. She ruffled his hair.
All the time. But I've got to keep you on your toes.
Consider me kept.
He brought his lips toward hers again, but stopped when a knock sounded at the door. Lissa pulled back from the near kiss, but neither of them broke from the embrace.
Don't answer, said Christian.
Lissa frowned, peering toward the living room. She slipped out of his arms, stood up, and walked toward the door. When she was several feet from it, she nodded knowingly.
It's Adrian.
More reason not to answer, said Christian.
Lissa ignored him and opened the door, and sure enough, my devil-may-care boyfriend stood there. From behind Lissa, I heard Christian say,
Worst timing ever.
Adrian studied Lissa and then looked at Christian sprawling on the bed on the far side of the suite.
Huh,
Adrian said, letting himself in.
So that's how you're going to fix the family problem. Little Dragomir's. Good idea.
Christian sat up and strolled toward them.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You're interrupting official council business.
Adrian was dressed casually for him. Jeans and a black t-shirt, though he made it look like designer clothing. Actually, it probably was. God, I missed him. I miss them all.
What's going on?
Asked Lissa. While Christian seemed to consider Adrian's arrival a personal offense, Lissa knew that Adrian wouldn't be here without a good reason, especially this early in the Moroi day. Although he had on his normal lazy smile, there was an excited and eager glitter in his aura. He had news.
I've got him, said Adrian. Got him trapped.
Who?
Asked Lissa, startled.
That idiot, Blake Lazar. What do you mean, trapped?
Asked Christian, as perplexed as Lissa.
Did you set out a bear trap on the tennis courts or something? I wish. He's over at the Burning Arrow. I just bought another round, so he should still be there if we hurry. He thinks I went out for a cigarette.
Judging from the scent wreathing Adrian, Lissa had a feeling he actually had been out for a cigarette, and likely shared in the round.
You've been at a bar this early?
Adrian shrugged.
It's not early for humans.
But you're not...
Come on, cousin.
Adrian's aura didn't have the muted colors of someone who was completely drunk, but yes, he definitely had a few drinks.
If pretty boy Ambrose was right about Aunt Tatiana, then this guy can tell us the names of other jealous women. Why didn't you just ask him yourself?
Asked Christian.
Because me asking about my aunt's sex life would be sick and wrong,
said Adrian.
Whereas Blake will be more than happy to talk to our charming princess here.
Lissa really wanted her bed, but finding out anything to help me sparked a new rush of energy within her.
Okay, let me at least get some different clothes and brush my hair.
While she was changing in the bathroom, she heard Adrian say to Christian,
You know, your shirt's kind of grungy looking. Seems like you could put in a little more effort since you're dating a princess.
15 minutes or so later, the threesome were on their way across court to a tucked-away bar inside an administrative building. I'd been there before and had originally thought it was a weird place to house a bar. But, after a recent stint of filing, I decided that if I were doing office work for a living, I'd probably want a quick source of alcohol on hand, too. The bar was dimly lit, both for mood and Moroi comfort. Adrian's joking aside, it really was early for Moroi, and only a couple patrons were there. Adrian made a small gesture to the bartender, which I presumed was some kind of ordering signal because the woman immediately turned and began pouring a drink.
Hey, Vashkov, where'd you go?
A voice called over to Lissa and the others, and after a few moments, she spotted a lone guy sitting at a corner table. As Adrian led them closer, Lissa saw that the guy was young, about Adrian's age, with curly black hair and brilliant teal eyes, kind of like Abe's recent tie. It was as though someone had taken the stunning color of both Adrian and Christian's eyes and mixed them together. He had a leanly, muscled body, about as buff as any Maroi could manage, and even with a boyfriend, Lissa could admire how hot he was.
"To get better-looking company,"
replied Adrian.